The Lord is with you. You've probably heard of the Gideons. I looked it up the other day, and as of 2015, the Gideons International has distributed 2 billion Bibles around the world. 2 billion Bibles. Maybe you remember if you received a Psalms and New Testament when you were in about grade 5, maybe, something like that. Or maybe you've seen one of those Bibles in a bedside table in a hotel or a motel where you stayed. And in these last few months, as we've been lingering in the First Testament, I've been sort of playing out this scenario in my head. I don't know. Maybe you've heard a story like this. Maybe even you have had a story like this. What if a curious hotel guest or someone who's really bored or a particularly troubled soul sits down in their hotel room and opens up that bedside table and pulls out that Gideon Bible? And let's just say they've never had any knowledge of the scriptures. They don't have a help or a guide, an instruction. It's not a study Bible with little notes on the inside. And they just started reading Genesis. They would encounter the story of creation, which is pretty great. But pretty soon they would be right in the middle of the troubling and strange and bizarre and fantastic story of the patriarchs, Moses and the Exodus. And if they're really keen, they would keep on reading, right? They would read those books of the law. As our story of the children of Israel continues right now, I have to wonder, exactly at what point would our Gideon Bible reader put down the book and say, some of this is pretty messed up. I don't know what to make of this. They told me this book was full of comfort, full of hope, full of stories of a loving God. I've heard so many good things about this God deal, but what am I reading? Really? Truthfully, we have a lot to be grateful for in our scriptures. We've inherited an immense collection of God-breathed writings, profound utterances with wisdom and hope, truth and beauty for a life of faith in the world. But if we're honest, we have inherited a very difficult book. Take, for instance, the concept of God's chosen people. Sounds like a pretty great idea, actually, doesn't it? What a great deal. It's like you've won the God lottery, and yet it's only a great deal just so long as you're one of those people, isn't it? Not chosen people? Them? Well, what a terrible deal it must be to be from one of those unchosen nations, forgotten peoples, or worse, men, women, and children who were just in the way. People who were an impediment, an inconvenience to the chosen ones. The people who call themselves the chosen ones are aiming to be the winners. We are the winners in a world full of losers. And what a lot of losers there are. Thank you, God, we're not one of those losers. As we've journeyed with these chosen people, we found ourselves rooting for them while they were enslaved. They were suffering under the hand of a brutal oppressor, and we were on their side. They were slaves in a strange land, crying out for deliverance. But then after their exodus and their liberation, for a time they were a wandering people, a nation without a home, longing for stability, security, a place to put down some roots, grow some crops, make a home, make a family. And this week marks the story of that arrival. The time of wandering has come to an end. And with all the ceremony, the priests and the ark and celebration and a pretty miraculous special effect with the waters parting, the children of Israel cross the Jordan River, and they enter the land of Canaan. What a good deal. But let's be clear, the story of Joshua is a story of conquest. Think of Caesar crossing the Rubicon with the 13th Legion. Think of the Confederate bombardment of Fort Sumner. Or, closer to home, how about Saddam Hussein back in the 90s? Those images of tanks rolling into the streets of Kuwait City. Crossing the River Jordan in full parade is the start of a military incursion. It's the first step in an annexation of a country. It's a declaration of war. And it's the beginning of a displacement of all those local peoples. And they're not faceless. They're not nameless. They don't just get called inhabitants. The writers of this book knows them by name. The text tells them they will drive out the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. I don't know if I've met any of those people, but they knew exactly who they were driving out. In case there's any doubt, life as one of the non-chosen people is one hell of a raw deal. Now, many of us, especially if we've become comfortable after many years in the church, we've become accustomed to sort of shelving troubling texts and stories like this in some back corner of our brains. There's an obscure corner of our theological matrix with lots of dust and spiderwebs on it. Kind of like that student who procrastinates their major term project. Or maybe someone who solves their car troubles by putting a piece of black electrical tape over their check engine light. There is a long-held Christian tradition, a tradition I mostly grew up with. It's the tradition of reading these texts quite flatly, and after you look up from reading something awful in the Bibles, you say, well, God is just God, and sometimes that involves unfathomable bloodshed, and so you'd better get used to that idea because you are a puny human and you can't ask questions like this. Let's move on. That answer never really did it for me. Another move, a move that feels like the right move, and I think in many ways is a good move, is to find experts, people who've been using their lives and their careers, their linguistic skills, their PhDs, and their ancient Near Eastern context, and they can help sort of massage these passages a little bit for us. Maybe with their help, these stories can be a little more palatable, a little bit less reprehensible, if there is such a thing. Maybe you've done this, but I've spent a lot of time searching for the perfect book. That one super scholarly work of someone who might tidy up all these gross and messy parts of scriptures. Wouldn't it be great if we could find someone whose collection of arguments and explanations could just clean up this ugliness for us? Now, truthfully, there are lots of times when scholars can help us get past a flat and narrow reading. There are plenty of nuances to be found, and there are times when the context does give us a better picture. Quite a few of these stories make sense if we know some of the background. Here and there, it is clear that these texts were sort of propaganda for the nation of Israel, a way to validate their own quest for power. Stories used to destroy the reputation of their enemies, brutally honest accounts of horrific events and terrible things that happened. But after all that's been done, after the scholarly tidying has been done, you will find that there is no perfect Bible explainer to be found. And there's no amount of scholarly bleach that will sanitize these ancient scriptures for us. Troubling texts of the Bible and some of the really horrible and shocking details, no matter what we do, they remain, even after we've made our best efforts to scrub them out, explain them, or ignore them. If an uncluttered Bible is what you're looking for, I promise that you will never be satisfied. And a little commercial. November 14th, our Theology Culture series is going to be a conversation about these passages of Scripture. And we're going to talk about different ways of understanding them and reading them together. Here's the thing, though. If someone handed me a Bible like that, and they didn't include all this stuff, if someone read to me an entirely sanitized account of a Bronze Age nation's faith and practice growing and developing over hundreds and hundreds of years, and if that story miraculously avoided any mean selfishness, if it didn't contain greed and lust and brutality, if there wasn't bloodshed and injustice, if that was the Bible they gave me, I don't know what use it would be to me or any of us. Could a book like that really speak to this thing we call the human race? So many selfish and cruel human beings. A text like that wouldn't speak to our long and bloody history. It wouldn't speak to us either. It really is amazing the level of brutal honesty that the Hebrew people were capable of when they told their story. Even when they edited and re-edited these texts, they pour out all kinds of troubling details. And we still cringe as we read them today, rightfully so. And so maybe with that Gideon Bible reader, we can ask, why is God so willing to be dragged through the mud with such horrible stories? Our Creator seems okay with taking the side of the oppressor sometimes. Why does God side with people like this? Last week, maybe you heard about it, we had a meeting. It was our first of our meetings that were part of our renewed partnership with E4C. And if you don't know what E4C is, it used to be called Edmonton City Center Church Corporation. It's now grown into this incredible not-for-profit in our city, and we're delighted to be renewing our partnership with them. For most of our time together, we met in a traditional talking circle, facilitated by someone from E4C named David Proden and Sharon Pasula. And around the circle, we each had a turn to share our hearts and to discuss different kinds of wellness in the city. We heard about E4C's work and what sort of wellness activities we might want to be a part of with them. A number of times, our conversation focused on E4C's significant work among Edmonton's Indigenous population. They talked about their efforts to take seriously the 94 calls to action outlined in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was only just published in 2015. As an offhanded comment, one of us, might have been me, asked, hey, how many Indigenous peoples or nations are a part of Treaty 6? And then there was a really long, awkward pause, because we didn't really have an answer. None of us were quite sure. And in case you need a refresher, Treaty 6 is a document drafted by the British and signed in 1876, and it recognizes the rights of Indigenous peoples as possessors of the land, making way, of course, for settlers. Yeah, settlers. Treaty 6 covers a huge swath of territory in what we'd now call Alberta and Saskatchewan. And each of us lives and sits on Treaty 6 land right now. So, what nations are covered by Treaty 6? Now, when I first had that question come to mind, I thought, oh, of course, I'll just go through the Rolodex and it'll be clear in my head. And then we all kind of had that sick feeling when we realized we're not quite sure. And at that traffic circle, in that talking circle, I had a moment where I felt a profound shame of my own ignorance on the topic. How can I know so many details about history in other countries? How can I know so much about World War II or the Roman Empire? Trivial bits of ridiculous data, wars and dates and names about all kinds of stupid things and TV shows and movies. And I didn't know the basic details about the history of the place where I lived. The treaty that affected so many people, Cree, Nakota, Chippewan, Anishinaabe. Names of people, nations. The Israeli people at least knew the names of the people, or that is, the children of Israel knew the names of the nations they were displacing. This was, after all, the treaty that paved the way for my people to come here. People that would come and settle. And my ancestors left their homes in Europe because they wanted stability and security. They wanted a place to put down some roots, plant some crops, make a home, grow a family. In my mind's eye, one half of my family lived the tale of adventure and struggle and hard work in a new land, traveling around North America like the Joads and the Grapes of Wrath, until they finally settled in Saskatchewan. And the other half of my family was living in a sod house, kind of like the Ingalls from A Little House on the Prairie. Settlers, each of them, reaping the fruits of Treaty 6 under the protection of the long arm of the British Empire, and let's be clear, with knowledge or otherwise, participating in the displacement of many peoples. And the truth is, we also know with great sadness that that treaty was a lot of broken promises that turned into many years of suffering. 95 calls to action might be a good start, long overdue. Here's the thing about being a people. Sometimes our best efforts and our best hopes end up having absolutely horrible consequences. One day we're crying out, God, have mercy on us, help us out. And the next day, or maybe even the same day, we're reaping the benefits of someone else's sufferings. Whether that's the sweatshop clothing on our backs, the cash crop coffee in our cups, the rare earth minerals in our phones, or the forgotten and broken treaties under our feet. We live in a complicated and cruel and mean world. Will our hands ever be clean? Can they ever be clean? When each of us looks at our own stories, it's fair to ask, why does God stick with people like this? The miracle of the gospel, of course, the good news is that we find that as the scriptures play out, God is in love with the entire mess of humanity. We share a common brotherhood and sisterhood of a troubled human race. It's bigger than any nation or nationality or language. We serve a God that gives a voice to lost people, a God who names forgotten people, a God who mourns displaced people. And even better yet, he has mercy on scoundrels and fools, ignorant consumers, desperate men and women, people with regrets, people who've made huge mistakes, people of sorrows. Almost entirely undeserving people of all sorts. Careless people, hopeless people, even settlers. People like you, people like me. Thanks be to God.